Good afternoon. Welcome. I'm humbled by the number of people interested in this topic. Apparently, we either have a problem or you're looking for something else, but we'll find out. My name is Kurt Drapers. I'm a software engineer in Xbox, or what used to be called Xbox Live Services. I'm responsible for the data platform inside Xbox for storage underneath all our commerce platforms. As such, we have this problem in spades. So that's maybe why you are interested. Just a show of hands, how many of you use handcrafted CRUD services today? Took a while. Okay, thank you. How many of you use OData? Okay, thank you. So for the other people, because like half of you didn't raise your hand, it's like you're interested in this or you have a problem. Who's interested? Thank you, otherwise you should not be here. Who has a problem? I can't help you with that one, I'm sorry. Would you mind sharing what kind of problem? You can do it in Dutch, I will translate it back. Custom built APIs? Yeah? JSON results? Which? Okay. Okay. Well, that's a whole laundry list. Thank you. So actually, we don't know each other, but that's sort of the list of things like, why do we want to do this? Well, it depends on where you're sitting, but it's like you want the ubiguous answer. In terms of, you want to be able to ask your service for data and get it back in a form that actually is highly applicable in a broad set of devices. How many of you targeting more than one type of device? Many more than 2 years ago. So that's exactly the problem that we're facing today. We're facing that as Microsoft. For those of you who came to my session yesterday about the rocky cloud road, where I shared some of the experiences that we have inside Xbox. We have a lot of clients that we need to serve up data to.
That's what we'll do.
Okay, so song and dance it is. Okay, overview time. So what's OData trying to solve? And so right now it's like one of the things that we have inside the industry is like when it comes to data interoperability, we don't really have a protocol. And what's a protocol? Well, a protocol is a set of agreements of how we want to interact with things like queries. We all know is like if you write a standard web service, it's very easy to do a get. And if you do a get by ID, you can map it to a controller, and all these things are very trivial. Reality is that it's like you have a lot of different kind of queries that you need to create. And so there are two strategies. You can create a method for every permutation that you can think of, maybe with a lot of overloads. Or you can now parse the request query URI that comes in and create some kind of query syntax. And the goal of OData is to standardize around this. So regardless of the data that you're exposing through the website, or to the web service, I should say, sorry, it's like the interaction model is ubiquitous. So it is always the same interaction model. The other aspect is it's like it should be able to proffer up its data to a wide variety of devices and project over a lot of data sources. It should really not matter if you are exposing a relational database, although that's where OData sort of has its roots. And I'll talk about that when we get to the entity data model binding aspect and what the role of the data model is. But we're exposing file systems inside Xbox with it. We are exposing alerting systems with it. And so it's like it's not just restricted to the fact that it's like you need a rectangular form. With OData 4.0, the other thing that we added is like the ability to have complex structures as types, so which allows you to much closer reflect and express things like which are very common in a JSON payload. The last aspect is like you need to return that data in a format that is widely used and widely understood. You should not require that you create a proxy. I'm an anti-proxy person to begin with, for the main reason that it actually creates strong binding between many clients to a single service, and so now you have yourself cornered into a maintenance problem. Because every time your contract changes, which happens to change quite often, I found with customers and even in our own organization, you now need to go update your clients. That on itself would not be that bad if there was a proper versioning strategy that came along with that, but it's like that's not the case, or that was never the case in OData either. So these are things that you don't want to run into, and so that's what we're trying to do. So what is OData? So first of all, it's exposing a CRUD interface through an HTTP endpoint. It does this through REST-based operations to support CRUD, so creation, reading, updating, and deleting resources, and additional capabilities, and I'm focusing on additional. You don't have to do this. If you need it, it's there for you. There are many people that is like, just use the standard CRUD operations, the get, the puts, and the posts. What you can do, filtering, sorting, paging, you can now add your own custom operations called actions, and you can add your own filters. We can do delta updates. All these things are possible. It's a service-centric design. A service reflected is over a model, and so you can actually host multiple models if you would want to. And you can do this over schematized or schemaless data sets.
The last one is like, of course, your filter capabilities will be highly restricted. But other things like sorting and paging might still be very useful. The return format is like we started out returning either XML or atom feeds. That's how OData started. The first incarnations of OData, the only thing they did was angle brackets and atom feeds. And we know how verbose angle brackets are. So I'm very happy that we now switched natively to JSON format in 4.0, and that's the default format to be returned. Now, when we're talking about what it is, it's like we should quickly talk about what it's not. It's not a replacement of any database technology like ODBC or SQL clients or the TDS protocol. It doesn't replace other things in the data access stack or the BI stack like XMLA. You can expose data sources like that with it, but it's not a replacement protocol for that. It would be not very efficient to replace TDS, tabular data streams in SQL, with a REST-based JSON protocol. Okay. So what is OData a Microsoft thing? Yes, it started off as a Microsoft thing. It actually is now a standards thing. OASIS is the body that governs what is going in and what's the latest state. If you go to, I think I have more battery problems. Okay, thankfully I have a built-in mouse that does something. Okay, all right, there we go. So if you go to the OData, zoom it in for you guys. OData.org website, you will find all the documentation and references to source code as well. OData is a protocol. A lot of people think that OData is the implementation. No. We have an OData implementation. We have actually now two, of course, because we need to confuse you, otherwise we have nothing to talk about at conferences. We now have two. But OData itself is a protocol. It's a specification of how we interact. More maintenance. So within that specification, we specify like what the URL structures are, what payloads are, what headers, etc., are being used. We've done this 4 times already, so we're cool. So the specification itself is like is the guideline. Everybody can implement this. There are implementations right now in Java. There are client libraries in multiple languages like objects, the Mac, C++, Objective-C, JavaScript, etc. So all these environments are available. I need to move now. I'm just making you part of the story now. No. All right. Sorry. Yep. We can go. So right now, where are we? As I said, it's like OData is the protocol. We have two implementations. So we recently switched, actually, and 3 years ago, we started adding OData support into Web API. At that point in time, the open source implementation of a set of APIs for ASP.NET. OData at that point in time was a very small implementation in Web API. So one of the caveats when you start doing this yourself is you need to be aware is like which Web API version you actually are consuming. Because if you're consuming the wrong version, it's like you will not have access to all the greatness that we're actually discussing right now. There also, from day one, has been, yay, thank you. I haven't turned this one off, I'm not sure if that, okay, fine, thank you. So the first implementation was called Web Service WCF Data Services. And it, actually that was a lie.
It was called WCF, but it only inherited by name. Because if you truly know WCF with its general architecture and how providers works and how formatters fit in and all these things that are replaceable, and then you walked up to WCF Data Services, you quickly figured out it's like, this is a marketing trick. You only share things by name. The implementation is actually not that much insane or the same. There were things that were shared, of course. But going forward, we will only invest in Web API. So I'm happy that there are many people that are interested in Web API. And so the OData implementation for Web API is being pushed forward by a set of developers that are in Redmond. They publish to open source on a frequent basis because Web API is hosted on CodePlex as part of the ASP.NET source code, in case you didn't know that. So right now, we released the protocol in February. We started updating ODL, the OData library. We'll talk about what that is to support 4.0. Right now, the latest version is 6.2. And we released in April the web data support for it, which is currently coined 6.1. At the same time, we moved the WCF data services to open source. And so 4.0 support, in the current protocol support in WCF data services, is 3. And it's up to the community to actually bring it to 4.0, just so you know that's documented in that blog post. Okay, enough architecture. Let's talk about what you need. So there are two aspects of our OData architecture. There is the server side and there is the client side. Technically, you do not need a client. It's a REST call. And you can make that REST call. You can simply do a GET. I will show you that using RESTMAN later. You can do a GET. Problem of not shaving is that it's making noise on the recording. Sorry. And so you can send a GET request and get the result set back in the resource format that you asked for. Resource formats as described, JSON, default, XML, or AtomPub. Okay? The environment is built up in a couple of things. If we look at the server, you have some data source that you want to expose. Most of our demos that I'll use today, I'm actually using some in-memory collections, so it runs everywhere. But you can make that everything. As I said, we use file systems, we expose them, databases, alerting systems, etc. The outer shell is our service, and this is where the interaction with Web API is most prevalent. This is where we integrate inside the ASP.NET hosting system. Right, we can therefore be a self-host, which means you can write an exe and run a standalone exe, which proffers up an HTTP port or multiple of them and serves up requests. You can also integrate yourself inside the ASP.NET or IIS websites, of course. That's up to you. I'm a big fan of command lines. So the only thing that you'll see me use are command lines. That's because my, we'll leave that for the readers, sorry. Next layer down is so now we are able to serve up requests. So we have an HTTP listener. We can send requests and responses back because that's taken care of by Web API. The next step down is that we actually now need to interpret the OData protocol. And so the OData library, ODL, that actually implements the specification. Web API at the outer layer doesn't know anything about the specification. ODL does. It knows two things. It knows how to take a request and parse it, and it presents it to you as an object model. And you can tell ODL to create a response in the OData format
that then can be sent back. So that's the glue that sits in between. And within that, what is OData exposing through the protocol is the OData model. And what is the model representing? Well, it's the data structures that you want to expose. If these are products, or if these are customers, or files, we don't care, but you have to describe them somehow. Okay? So that's the role of the model. The clients can interact with this, as I said, either through straight REST. You can do HTTP client, do a GET, PUT, POST, and it simply works. For convenience, there is a OData client library, and the place where this really helps you is in constructing queries. Within that, if you are using a typed model, we can actually consume that model, and we have a facility called link over URLs that allows you to create queries as link expressions, which are actually being translated as URI queries. And then it's like we do a GET or a POST, depending on how this works. So these are all the libraries that are involved. I'm not going to walk through those. If you're interested, you can find that out. So the general model that a lot of people use, you have some OData service. And the first thing that the client does is like it needs a metadata request. What is the metadata request? Well, the metadata request is like get the definition of the model and what's in there. Because now I know what I can reason about when I'm making a request to the data service. So an OData service technically doesn't have to, but in order to be a good citizen in the OData landscape, you need to expose your metadata endpoint and your service document. Okay? This is what exposes your model. Now it's like a client can go up there and ask for information. So, see if I can work this. Yes. So if you want to do a GET, for example, you simply send a GET to the address, namespace, accounts, and in this case, an identifier of 110. And that will actually get the information out. For the client, in order to do this, he will write some client code, just like he would use entity data model code. He ponies up a context. That context refers nothing else than to the local host and to this namespace. The types exposed in this context are generated based on this model. And then it's like you write your link query. That link query, of course, is delayed executed until you do the update or the safe changes. Okay? That's the standard trick with link and how the interaction model works. So the client takes care of serializing, deserializing payloads. As I said, you don't have to do this. If you want to consume, so in all honesty, in my team, what we do is we use JSON.NET to do exactly this, serialize, deserialize payloads, because we standardized on JSON, and we want our services to work over key value pairs to promote loose coupling. And so that's why it's like we actually don't use the OData client in this case. You can generate requests using link to URL, and then it's like we have some facilities in there that does entity tracking. So one of the added values that the client does, if you really have especially a relational model and you're making changes to related set of objects, the entity tracking in there allows you to submit all the changes as a batch. And so that makes your life a lot easier. I do want you to think about the downside. Because seriously, it's like if you're talking to a web service, you should think about it as web resources. A resource is is addressed to a resource locator. And what you're trying to do is reflect the relational model, and you're going to update multiple resources, and you want to do that as a batch. Huh, what are your consistency guarantees? I see people, probably if you ask, it's not good. Well, it depends on the provider. I can't tell you the answer. We do support batching, but I know in our system where we have 60 SQL servers, where it's like we're sharding over through hash-based algorithm, I cannot make any guarantees if you don't hit the same hash bucket. Because otherwise I don't know if you're hitting the same node. And I will not start a distributed transaction for you, even if you pay me. Right? Because that's the anti-availability matter. Right? It's like in a distributed service, it's like you don't want to do that. So I'm not saying don't do this. What I do say is like you seriously have to think about what it does and what the consequences are. So let's talk about the model. And so the information that you're exposing is exposed to something based on the entity data model. The entity data model is another specification. It will tell you how the type systems work. And therefore, it's like you now have a contract for defining complex structures. So it will tell you that there is an EDM int 32, and the value range is blah to blah, and how strings behave, and so all the data types that we care about are actually defined inside that specification. So the other thing it specifies is not only the type system, but also the ability to have relationships between objects and how to navigate between these two services. So you get something like this. You have an entity container, which is the outer curve of your model. Inside your model, you have entities. In this case, we have two entities, categories and products, and they have a binding. And that binding allows me to navigate from a category to a product, or from a product to a category, depending on how we implement that navigation link. And you can see here, this is like, here is the relational model at work. Like a lot of this derives from the relational set theory and the fact that tables have foreign key relationships and to other tables. Another opinion, if you don't mind, right? In our world, this is strictly forbidden now. We don't want to see any of these lines. We only expose entities as resources. Again, in favor of loose coupling. And so that's an opinion. We're religious about it. It pays off for us. Not saying that you have to follow it. So at the end of the day, your EDM model is a bunch of XML, where it's like we specify two important aspects. An entity, if you want to be able to retrieve it uniquely, must have some sort of key. Otherwise, we don't know what you're going after. So there needs to be some uniqueness in the system. So that key needs to be there. We have some magic, I call it, based on the fact that it ends on ID, that if you don't explicitly specify it, we will look for a property with the name ID. That is like pretty language specific, and B, it's like it might not always be what you want. Then it's like you see the two types that follow that. So at minimum, it's like we need to denote what the type is. In this case, it's a string, and if it's nullable or not. The nullability aspect is actually important to note. If you want to write fluent link queries, you don't want to have nulls propagate. And so you want to make sure is like that you understand the nullability of your types. And then this one is like the navigation property, which says it's like, who do we navigate to? So in this case, it creates a full namespace to product, and so it will actually navigate to this product guy over here, and that establishes the link between these two entities. So that's how the model is represented and how things are flowing into the system. So this allows us to do now things that automatically are exposed in the URI. So if you look at the category entity, by default, it is exposed under the entry point of the service, which right now we're using OData, which is an arbitrary name. This can be anything, and through routing, we can take away this whole service notion to begin with if you want it to be on the full service path. We expose by default the name of the entity, and then there is a selector for the ID. One caveat which we have not solved, which I know people are not happy with, especially if you're coming from a JSON background, is that this casing is case sensitive. And that's, it's like, I hate that personally, because URIs are not supposed to be case sensitive. B, it's like this reflects a C# notation more than anything else, because in Java you wouldn't have it, or in JavaScript. So it's directly related to the fact that inside your entity model, categories is spelled with an uppercase C, just so you know. Products, same thing. Now, how is that link being exposed? The link is being exposed as a sub-select underneath the products. After you select your product, you can now navigate through product, and that will invoke the link and navigate the linking strategy. So things you can imagine here, suppose that you're exposing a file system. Right? It's like you would do this with, like you could say, it's like, oh, it's like I'm on a file, but I want to know what the directories are. And then it's like I want to know what files are. It's like, and you can make this a very recursive pattern that allows you to navigate through the system. All right? So that's cool. So we have a model. Now what happens when we actually request some data? Sorry. So when we request data, the protocol by definition will return some metadata. In the older OData versions, I'll show you after this slide, it was actually, you didn't have an option. You would always get back metadata. And I will leave it up to you to judge the quantity. Right now, it's like we have three options. We actually can provide you with what we call full metadata. This is fully typed. It actually tells us exactly is like what the type system is like what the namespaces are, and what is in here. We can minimize it. So we know it's like some basic information, and so we have a pointer to the full metadata, or we simply say no metadata. And so this tries to cater to where the industry has evolved into and what is being a common practice, especially in web services, whereas like a JSON client hardly asks for the data, for metadata at runtime. A developer might want to look at it at design time, but he doesn't want to do this at runtime. Beforehand, it's like we didn't provide you with that option. So let's go. All right. I already had my URIs popped out. All right. All right, so I'm going to a public website. Can you see this, or do I need to blow it up? I'll,
don't hear anything, so that probably means I have to blow it up. So I'm going to, there's a couple of reference implementations that are hosted actually on the odata.org site. And they use the familiar Northwind database. For those of you who are SQL Server users, you probably remember that database. And so that's being exposed. There are some other examples there too, but this is one that is like a lot of people like because it's something that they can relate to and they have access to the source for it, et cetera. So the first thing that we do is we construct a GET. We're going to the V3 protocol. It's like this is how the service is exposed, so we can actually switch between them. We go to the Northwind service, which exposes the Northwind service document, and we ask for metadata. And so what we'll get back as part of that GET is the whole schema that we have and are familiar with in Northwind. So we have a categories table. We know that it has an identity column. It's an int 32. It's not nullable, et cetera, et cetera. It also defines the relationship types, for example, that you have. So it's like you can navigate from products to categories. And so all this information is in here. So this is the metadata document that is being exposed through the endpoint. And as I said, depending on your style of programming, if you're a JSON programmer consuming this, you probably will want to look at this at development time. If you're a .NET programmer and you use the proxy will look at this. It will consume this, and then it will spew out classes. And now you bind to some classes. The risk here, of course, is that that guy evolves and didn't tell the client, and you will find out at runtime. Because the client doesn't check any version or something. It checks the version of the protocol, but we don't allow you to say, it's like, this is schema version 1.1. This is version 1.2. You have to be smart enough to handle that. So what I've seen customers do is actually expose entities that reflect this information. So they actually have a handle on it. And they can detect at runtime saying, it's like, oh, you're returning a new version? That's not good because I don't understand that. And they can gracefully fail. But it's something that you want to think about. So let's go up to our request. Let's change this to a 4.0 metadata request. Send it to the service. And the EDM, the metadata document, because EDM, the entity data model, prescribes that this is XML, has not changed. So even though it's like we'll see in a minute that the responses are going back in JSON, it's like the entity data model is always reflected as an XML set of data. All right, so now let's pony up a request. Let's just grab it out of my editor right now. Well, actually, first I want to do this. So, no. Scroll to the top. It's like my mouse is a little bit. Okay. Here we go. So what did I ask for? Well, I asked for all the orders. Okay? So it will tell me it's like which protocol version. It's like it will tell me which version of the service document I was binding to. And then it will start returning me a collection, in this case, of order entities. So here you have an entry. You will find the information. And then it's like you can start navigating the maze. So the idea behind this is that you can go, if you ask for one, you can start navigating to the other. So So for example, if you want to move to shippers, it's like you can start traversing this link, and you can go from there. So let's narrow this down and actually ask for one order, because that gives us a better overview of what's in here. So here we have a single order that was returned. And so you see there's a lot of ceremonial payload that comes back, because it's like we actually describe what's in there. And then here you actually have the data of the information that you actually care about. So this is the V3 format. Let's switch this over. Let's do it this way. And let's make this V4. So I'm switching protocols right now. I'm pushing it over. And this is the result. Now I'll ask you, what do you prefer? Right? If you're a web developer writing AJAX calls, I know which one you want to pick. A is like this one can directly bind to a JSON object. And B is like you don't have the overhead of the metadata payload. Okay. So that's some serious considerations that you have to think about. It's like when you engage with the OData protocol, it gives you a lot of functionality, but there are costs hiding at certain places that you have to be aware of. All right. This is not where I was. Is where we were. So besides dealing with serialization, the most important function of the OData library is to be the URI parser. Because you're getting all these requests as a URI object, and you need to be able to rip that apart and look at it. Before this, before we actually produced a separate library for this, this was intertwined in the WCF data services code. And on itself, that wasn't that bad, but it's like you couldn't influence it. You couldn't grab behind the curtain and do something with it. The other thing that it made it very hard to write very performing services. Because it's like it was part of the execution model effectively. It would generate the queries from here and then go down into the guts of the data source, get the information back, and present it up to the service. The only way around that in WCF data services is to write a custom provider. And that means that you're literally on your own dealing with expression trees. And I've showed that 2 years ago at the same conference, actually in the same room on the same last day. I didn't know what's wrong with me that they always gave me that slot. Anyhow, so the world has evolved now, and it's like when we now have a library that allows you to parse things. And so not just to talk about parsing, it's interesting to look at the kind of operators that we allow you to return. So you can specify a top operator, which effectively gives you the first set of entities. Out of your result set, you can skip over them. And combined with them, what do you have? Paging, yes, thank you. All right. And this construct of paging flows all the way down, so it's like you can actually create a very efficient implementation of paging. And that's very handy. And this is why, it's like again, I'm pushing back on people that want to use relationship links between entities. Because if I give you 10 rows that are all related to hundreds of more rows, what am I giving you? Hopefully we're lazily hydrating, but there is a question is like of expectation of the client. So these are all things that you need to consider. You can define what output format you want by specifying the format field. You can also set, of course, the application payload header like you normally do, but sometimes you don't have access to the headers from where you are, either in your code or because of the usage of the tool. For example, Excel consumes OData feeds. I cannot, in OData or in Excel, I cannot set a header. I can set a query argument that is being passed. I can specify order bys, filters, selects. So what are selects? Well, selects are projections. So I can take out, it's like say I have an entity with 5 fields. I only want 2. That's called a projection of 2. So I was like, I will select those out. And expend, what that will do is it will actually expend the navigation properties on a given object. Right? And so then it will start to bring in all the related fields. Again, it's like all useful as long as you know what the implications are, what needs to be done. So that allows you to go and do something like this. So here we have a typical query string, again projected on the odata.org site. We're asking for order details. We want the top 5. We want to select order ID and product IDs. We want to skip the first and then filter on a order ID greater than actually the one that I was using earlier on. What that results in is that the OData library creates a OData URI object, which allows you to walk the AST, the abstract syntax tree, and it will split out, that is like you have a top count, you have a skip count, that you have a select expend, then have the list with all the items in there, a pass selector that says I have an order ID and a pass ID, so you now know it's like how to go from there, and it has the filter clause. If you have this information, you don't need OData, anything from OData after this. So if you just want to use OData lib to get a handle on these kind of standardized queries and do whatever you need to do with it, that's okay. You have a question, sir? So the question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I said by default it's like we're paging. How can I force it to return everything? And so actually that's the fact if it's paging is an implementation aspect of the OData service. Secondly, if you're in the old model, it's a function of the provider serving up underneath you. So there are 2 places where this is determined. By default, it's like it actually, the bottom layer, the service provider, if it didn't get a predicate pushed down, it will return everything. Then the upper layer, who actually returns the entities returns into the result set projected out in the response, that layer by default has a page size of 100. But that's overridable in the code. And so then it's like you can go from there. The question is if you really want that. I'm a strong believer that you want to learn people how to use paging. Because it's like no human is looking at lists that are longer than X, and UX designers have opinions about that, but it's like if I'm on my phone, I don't want to see 100 items in the list. I want to see a few, and I want to be able to page. And I think with the form factors of devices these days, that it's very important to be highly efficient, both for the device as well for the service. But both scenarios are possible. If you want it all, you can get it all. Okay, so we're done in the OData library part. Let's talk about the service. So the service aspect, that allows you to build up your hosting system. So there is a service library. And that service library builds up an HTTP stack, which is part of Web API. It shares the same attributes these days. And this is why it has become so powerful. because there are a lot of things that you can now do inside your host that weren't possible before. And so you can build up a service from there. So you don't need to know the OData protocol. It's like there are two ways we can do this. You can use POCO objects like you're used to, and you can create your controller in two ways. There is an OData conventional model builder, which literally takes three lines to create a model out of this. And so this is what you then start feeding into the infrastructure. You create a builder, you add the entities to the builder, and then it's like you pass it on to construct a model out of that. So this all works inside the web API environment. So I've tried to project out, it's like what the layering is and where things are happening. As you might know, there is this whole poster about web API message routing and it's like how that's actually how messages, requests, and responses flow through the system. And so it's very important to understand how the message flows through the stack, because that tells you where it's like you need to do what. For example, where do we do security? Well, hopefully here, at the message handler level. That's synonymous now with every website or other web services that you would build. Before that, it's like it was, there were call-outs and you need to register stuff. Right now, it's like we arrived finally at a point where there's symmetry in the development model, and now you can also start to reuse aspects. So the ThinkAware OAuth library that allows you access to Google Mail and Facebook and LinkedIn just plugs in here, and from that point on, it's like you flow with token with your request, and so you can check downwards if you want to do authorization. But authentication would happen here in a message handler. Right? Authorization, depending on where it needs to be checked, of course, needs to be able to flow through the whole aspect. So the message comes in, then it's passed to a controller selector, which is the entity of code that is actually going to handle your request. The controller is a derivation of OData controller. This is a new one that was added by moving to Web API. And there is like it goes through this flow. First of all, it needs to select the action. What does it need to do? Is this a get, a put, a post, a patch, a delete? Okay. We need to choose a formatter based on the result set or the type that you want to have back. We need to bind it to the model because we need to be able to project over it. And we need to look at the query options. At that point, we pass it into the action filter, which executes the action. Pass it into another action filter, which passes through the formatter, which then results in the HTTP response. That is how the message flows through the system. I've tried to project the entities that actually sit here and help you doing this kind of work and how they relate to each other. So EDMLib, the model, as used by Model Builder, it has it. If you have spatial data types, we have a spatial library that feeds into this, that can be directly used. OdataLib we talked about, and then the framework, if you're actually interacting with the database, you don't have to, as I said before. So there are a couple of components at play. You need to be able to construct the model. And in the past, in WCF data services, there were two flavors. Reflection or custom. And that were the two choices you had. You had, yes, you had an entity data model, one, but that used reflection indirectly. And you had one that went over link over objects, which uses reflection. And if you wanted to do something out of the ordinary, which was not that out of the ordinary, you had to write your own provider. For example, I wrote a multi-tenant one in the last at last conference where we did multi-tenancy. right? Because like we need to route the user based on the header that flows into the OAuth claim. We need to route you to the right database. Something that in a multi-tenancy world you might want to do. That requires you to write a whole provider. In this case, we can actually do this. We can have a single model if all customers would share the same data set. If that's not true, you can have models for every tenant. But now you have another problem. Say you have hundreds of tenants. You're not going to pre-populate hundreds of models. So you want to be able to fold it in. You want to be able to cache it, age it out, etc. So right now is like we finally give you the option to construct selectively what goes into the model and go from there. Then it's like you need to construct a query. And we said it's like we use ODL semantics over this, the syntax tree, that after you've done that, you can now use link expressions over an iQueryable, and that you can push that onto link over entities or link over objects, or again, do your own thing. The most interesting feature is routing, because this allows us, right, in the old web services or WCF data services model, it's like the controller controlled the navigation strategy, and therefore it controlled the URI namespace. So there was a tight coupling between classes, property names, navigation links, and how that reflected into the resource model that was exposed on at the service level. So that's no longer needed, just like with routing, because we can come up with a complete custom scheme there and start to navigate that. Formatters we talked about. The other thing that has changed in the advantage of web API is support for typeless. You can have completely typeless payloads and feed it in as long as you have a unique way to identify a resource. Because that is, of course, a must-have. So some examples about metadata and routing. And so you basically have a route table, just like you have in Web API. So since the OData protocol doesn't mandate that you actually expose a metadata document or a service document, by default, it's omitted. If you want to interact with your service, I'm assuming now that you're building a 4.0 service, if you want to interact with downstream clients, 3.0 clients, there is a mandate that you have to expose the metadata document and the service document. And so you need to pass that in into the routes and map that to the right place so they actually that information get exposed at the right point in time. That's the only sort of orchestration you need to do to actually make old clients work. There are some other interesting things that allows you to, in this first example, have relationship nodes. So you want to be able to avoid making an extra call on the byGetID function that would expose the navigation link. And so you can create a route that allows you to navigate through the parent ID to a navigation property. And so the whole point here is that you end up with a URI structure that actually makes sense for the consumer of the service. Right. Routing helps you in two places. That one that I just mentioned, which is how the service exposes this. And it's like, don't underestimate the value there, because that is the public contract of your service. That is what other developers bind to. If you're Facebook, the relationship to developers is done through these kind of constructs. So there is a lot of value that is being based on that. The other aspect is, what if that particular call is not implemented at the same entity for whatever reason? We all know that historical code has its quirks, and certain times functions reside in places where we don't expect them. Routing allows us to still have a consistent namespace in the URI hierarchy, but map it to another function that is somewhere else. So that allows us to do that. The second one is like we can manipulate links through this, through the link attribute inside the route. And it's like we can start to shorten things. So first of all, you saw me use odata slash. But if we want to make these all root entities, we actually can through these three examples. And so that allows us to be much more expressive in the service that we're building. So then we need to construct our model. As I said, the convention builder still uses reflection because it's like you just give it an entity, so otherwise it doesn't know how to get there. It will look up types, property info, and method infos in case you're wondering what kind of reflection it does. And you can go from there. The attribute convention, you can attribute things on it, saying it's like this is a key, this is a data member. Sometimes you have properties on your classes that you don't want to expose, which you then decorate with ignore. And concurrency check is a new attribute that is introduced to support etags. Etags allows you to do optimistic concurrency. All right, so instead of pessimistic concurrency where you hold a log, well, that's a little hard because it's a request response model. And so you don't have a session context and you don't want to maintain state in your OData service. So you don't want to rely on pessimistic concurrency through locking. So the model that you should be using instead is through an optimistic concurrency model. If you're a SQL Server user, that means that you really want to have a timestamp field or a row version field in your table. Every time the data changed, it's like that value is automatically recalculated. And what happens underneath the cover is that if you do an update, we see it's like, hey, it's like your etag and our etag is not the same, so you're not at the right state. And we will reject you, and that causes you a lot of grief. So optimistic concurrency is a good thing if you're actually building a web service. Now, you can also take full control through a set of entity setters and configuration properties, and that allows you to do something like this. You construct a model builder. You'd say, it's like, well, this is my entity. This entity needs to be exposed as products. Aha. So if you were wondering earlier, so I was harping on the fact that it's like it was case sensitive. Well, it is still case sensitive, but if you want to force case it in the URI notation, flipping this P to lowercase will get you that result without having to adjust the uppercase P on your class name. All right. But it does force you to actually use a custom model builder. The next thing, so you said this is what the entity is named. Now you're going to tell it what the entity type is, if it has a key, because we need to use a unique resource locator, the properties that it has, and the types of information that it's passing in. Okay? So the action here, I skipped over action. So this is an action. It's effectively a call on an entity that we expose. So here you have a action on the entity products that's called rate, and you pass in an integer rating value, and then it returns, in this case, a double. I don't know what the meaning of the double is, but you can also return values out of a function. So what that allows you to do is, in your resource model, expose custom actions that are callable that you can now map onto sort of RPC-style operations. So then the last thing is that we actually need to be able to query. So you create your query, you pass in the filter. This will go into one of two things. First of all, you can take the simple route and say, it's like, hey, we mapped to this function, either through routing or implicit. If I'm not routing, get products will be the get function on the products entity, on the product entity, I should say, sorry. And it returns either an IEnumerable or an IQueryable. And what is the difference between the two? Well, if it's an iQueryable, it will just return the result set to me, and then it's like I have to do all the massaging myself over here. If it's an iQueryable, I can push predicates down. And so now at the layer below this, I can actually do more sophisticated things. Hopefully, I have a sophisticated provider. And so if you have a sophisticated provider, this could result in the whole predicate being pushed, per se, to your SQL Server database. You can also use query options, and this allows you to actually push that into the function itself, or you can actually do everything yourself and convert the AST filter and be in control yourself. And all this, again, is made possible by the fact that it's like the web API infrastructure is highly composable. We already looked at routing. I'm sorry, this is out of order. I added the examples at the end. Formatting. So the formatting part is not as interesting, but it's like it is overwritable. So as I said, we have JSON, XML, Atom. You can interject your own type formatter if you have to, and then go from there. All right. Let's look at some code. Minutes. Yay. Okay, let's leave. I'll start RestMan later again. I don't need this. All right, let me make sure I do this in the right order. All right, so the first thing I do is actually this is my handy dandy spy tool. For those of you who were in my session this morning, this is a way to look under the covers which requests are at the HTTP sys layer. And the reason why I want to do that is like I can show you what is actually the result. I'm going to start first off the service that we're going to look at in a moment. So this is a self-hosted OData service. It's just an XE or a command line tool. And I'm going to start my client tool. And so first of all, actually, I want to start another client tool. I want to go to LinkPad. So LinkPad, for those of you who don't know, is actually has the ability to access OData clients directly, or OData services directly, I'm sorry. So this right now is localhost 50231. And so first thing it does, it starts to populate. And let's go look at my spy. And what does spy tell us? Well, spy tells us that we actually sent a metadata request to the service. So the first thing that this tool does is it walks up and does a metadata request. It does a get $metadata on the endpoint. Now, what you see it do, it actually sends it to $metadata right at the endpoint. It didn't say it was OData or anything else, which if you would go look at the code of the service, and if I blow this up for you, you will see that it's like inside the main loop, we have a base address, and then it's like we create a controller with route name OData. And so the default route is still OData, but then it's like it's rerouted to the roots just like we showed you actually in the beginning to make that a bit easier. So I can navigate through this. I can expand this. Let me see if my... And then I can ask it a query. So let's go to products because I actually have some products. I can say take the first 100. It will go send the request. And it needs to initiate the information. And there we go. So here we have our first 100 results. It comes out of memory, so it's like it actually needed to populate the collection. So now it's interesting, and this is why I have the spy tool up. It's like, I'm using the clients. Right, that little client thingy, proxy that was generated. every time you will make a call, you will by default, unless you suppress it, get a metadata call. Well, that's wasteful. Right? And so if you're not looking at something like this, you would forget that, you wouldn't turn it off, and then you would pay for it, which is unnecessary. All right. Okay, so enough playing around with LinkPad. LinkPad is actually very helpful. There's one more thing I want to show you. Let's actually get some suppliers. Because what I want to show you is the fact that it's like we actually have the ability to return complex types as part of this. So if you look at the definition of the supplier contract, so if we go to the supplier model, all right, supplier model is an ID, an int, and an address. An address actually is this complex structure. And so if you return that, it actually would result as an embedded complex type. And if you would look at the JSON, it's effectively an embedded JSON object within that, right, as you would expect. So this is how these things map to each other. And right now, this because product family says it's zero, it's like there's no maps or navigation links to the products table for this particular one. All right, so let's go and like kill this guy. Thank you. Took some effort. So let's start it in the debugger, and we can use that to actually go from there. All right. So the first thing that we're being asked is, like, while we're starting up, is so we come out of self-host. Right? In self-host is like we started describing our hosting environment. This is plain web API stuff. We added some message handler. We added our routing conventions, so we can do that. And right now, it's like we're in this OData route mapping that is going to be installed. So the first thing that it does, it's like it now needs to get the model, because it's like the OData service will not do, hopefully, that you realize by now, if we don't have the model. So I have two versions implemented. I have the get implicit EDM model and the explicit one. So that's that, of course, doesn't work. Let's do this. Let's look at the explicit one, and then we'll step through the implicit one. So the explicit one is the elaborate one, where it's like we actually define each product separately and then go through. And so that would look like this. It's like you're defining what your object context is. You find what types are in there, what links are available, and what version you want to expose it at. And so this also allows you to specify explicitly what kind of navigation model you want in case you have to be backwards compatible. Right? Otherwise, you would not use a V3, only if you have to. Okay, so here, this allows us to work with LinkPad. For example, because that's a V3 client that's built on 5.5 libraries. So we continue building up our model. We have product families. Then per entity type, we set up which properties and keys there are. We pass that in. And we build some navigations using Navigation Builder. And when that's all done, it's like we return the model constructed by the model builder into the product. Now compare that with like our implicit model building. That says it's like we're using a conventional builder. Again, remember this will do reflection. So it will reflect over products. We're augmenting it because like we're gonna have this rated product, which is a derivation from product. And then it's like we add family and suppliers. We create that and then we return the model. So now it's like I have my model. I can enable query support and turn on some diagnostics. And then it's simple API call for async listening, and I'm await right now. Okay, so right now I'm blocking until I get my first request. So let's trigger my client again. And my client is going to run some tests. Okay. And so the first thing is like when you remember the picture, let me try to make this a little bit bigger. Scroll up a bit, okay. So remember the first, if you think back of that diagram that I showed you, which tried to depict the flow, it's like we first had to determine the format. So the first actually visit that we make is to the formatter. And so that's a delegator that we're going to use to figure out what the format is. And so if I'm not mistaken, I had a breakpoint set. All right, yep. And the next one that I described is where we actually see if we have an action that we need to perform. In this case, there is no action that is like on the first call that we need to perform. So it's like we will fall out of that. And we don't have an action executing. Okay, then it's like we're going to look at the query string. We're going to parse the query. And, oops, excuse me. Need to remove my breakpoints, otherwise we will keep spinning and you don't like that. It's a waste of your time. Okay. All right, and now I'm actually in the iQueryable call for the service. So now it's like I'm inside the controller at my iQueryable point. I said it's like this was this projects over a DB, which is an entity data model context. So just like you have a repository model inside your websites in your MVC model, that same MVC model applies to this strategy as well. But you're now exposing it as a REST call. All right. And so I'll break this. It's going to dispose. I will keep going for a while, but it's like I noticed that we're out of time. So I'm going to cancel this. I'm sorry. I'm going to wrap this up. So what I wanted to show you today is how you can take OData inside the web API model and use it to host CRUD-like services. All right. The other things like that is like I wanted to at least as a takeaway is the flexibility that it provides. It allows you to set up a service with a few lines of code. But with any few lines of code example, it's like in reality, it's like you have to live with the consequences and the decisions made at that abstraction level. The advantage of this programming model over WCF data services is that it gives you the full control to actually move down into a layer that gives you 100% control over what's going on. The thing that I didn't touch on, which for us internally was the biggest reason to start adopting this and not WCF data services, is the ability that I can make async calls. Because everything in web data, or web API, sorry, is an asynchronous call. And that allows us to build highly scalable services. With that, I want to thank you very much for all of you attending. I was, as I said in the beginning, I was surprised so many people showed up. Sorry for the technical difficulties. And the song and dance that I have to perform while waiting. Please send in your evaluation forms. OData decided that the session is over. I will therefore close the program. And I want to thank you very much and have a nice day. Thank you. I will be here. So if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them either inside or outside. But the next speaker also wants to get in. Thank you.
Hou je daar rekening mee?